My top five podcasters, Chris Lambert, and probably myself, but this ain't about that. The Mundane Festival is where you're at. If you've been tapped in, you know what's up. If you're a first timer, hey, welcome to the club. The cost of admission is simply a subscription, then rating and reviewing it wherever you listen. Don't worry about change ups, the cast won't break up. Even when that $1 million contract show up, a stand up guy who's a stand up comedian with a stance on everything from food to media. So welcome to the show, please take your seat. Let's find out what he's got in store this week. Who, me? I'm Don Will, your opening act. Thanks for coming out. Please clap. The Mundane Festival. With your host, Chris Lambert.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Sunday, October 31st, 2021. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast listening apparatus. And if you're really into this thing, go over to Apple Podcasts, give this show a 5-star review, let everybody know why you like it, because it's simply the right thing to do. And if you want to take your love and appreciation of this show to an even deeper level, go over to patreon.com/mundanefestival and subscribe. $3 a month for hours and hours and hours of bonus content. And right now, I want to give a special thanks and a special shout out to Rodney and Denise. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for subscribing. I really appreciate you. And I think you're going to enjoy all the bonus content that's behind the paywall. This is episode 542. I have a super special guest, New York Times best-selling author Miran Feder, the author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. I'm going to have that conversation. I've got it. I had that conversation. I'm going to share that conversation that I had with her, with you, in a few moments. Right now, I just want to talk to you about one thing that's kind of been on my mind, and I've been thinking about it for a couple of weeks. And I don't want to believe this, but I can only talk about what I know. I think that Whole Foods has the best Jamaican beef patty that I've had in my life. And to most of you, especially the people of Afro-Caribbean descent, you might have checked out as soon as I said that. You might have said, who does Chris think he is? I'm a suburban kid. I'm a kid from Southern Maryland. I'm a kid from PG County, from suburban Maryland. I don't know. But what I've been to Golden Krust. And see, maybe Golden Krust is kind of all I can compare it to. And I thought Golden Krust is not bad, it's good. But just consistently, it just feels like Whole Foods has the best Jamaican beef patties. And their chicken patties are good, too. Like, I went to one Whole Foods in Ridgewood, and they didn't have the beef patties. So we got the chicken. I was like, I don't know. I'll get it. And those were good, too. And then on Monday, I went to Whole Foods and I was like, when I'm in there, I like to have them. You know, it's something you like to have a couple in the fridge so you can pull them out when you need it, you know? And I said, look, they're consistently the best that I've ever had in my life. And I said that to the dude that was at the deli counter, and he looked at me. He was kind of bewildered. He was like, really? And he went in the back, and this little Mexican woman came out. She's like, oh my God, thank you. He says they're the best he's ever had. And I think it made her day. And I think they were really good, but there's gotta be, I don't feel right about it. That's why I'm bringing it to you guys. I don't feel like, I mean, if they're good, they're good, but there's gotta be somewhere. There's got to be somewhere in the New York, in the tri-state area that has better beef patties than Whole Foods. I feel uncomfortable saying that one of the tentacles of Jeff Bezos's empire makes better Afro-Caribbean food than somebody else. So I need to be corrected. I'm putting myself out there. I'm making myself vulnerable, and I'm making myself available to be corrected. Can I be directed somewhere else in the tri-state area that has consistently good Jamaican beef patties? And I will go there. I will try it out. I will eat it. If it's good, I'll buy some and put them in the fridge if it's like a long way away from me. But I need to know this. The homie Damian Lemon could probably lead me in the right direction. I should text him too. But I can't. This has been going on for like over a month. And I feel like I've said it before. I feel like I tweeted this and nobody said anything. Nobody's corrected me. Maybe it's the algorithm. I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm being shadow banned. But I feel uncomfortable with the fact that Whole Foods has like really good Jamaican beef patties and chicken patties. So I need to be corrected. I know Whole Foods has good macaroni and cheese. I know they have great tuna fish. Even if you get the tuna with the cranberries in it, it's so good. So please, someone out there, tweet at me, email the show, let me know, and I'll figure it out. Because I feel uncomfortable. I feel uncomfortable with this. All right. So let's just get right into this conversation with Miren Fader. She was so kind to chat with me. I read her book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. It's fantastic. I really loved it, and I reached out to her. And she agreed to do it. Normally, we get a little longer to have a conversation with the guest, but she's super busy with the virtual book tours and the deadlines that she had to make. But I'm super grateful for her spending the time that she did. And she's going to come back. We'll get her to come back and have a longer chat with her. But this was great. And I want to just share my conversation with the very lovely and delightful and supremely talented Miren Fader. Are you in LA now?
Yeah, I'm in LA.
How's the pandemic and everything being handled out there?
I mean, at first it was awful. This was like the worst place to be in addition to New York. And now we're doing so much better, but it is, I mean, thankfully I'm in a place where a lot of people wear masks all the time, but it still just feels weird. Like, when is this ever going to end? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel it still feels weird to me, but it's almost like if you got vaccinated and you're doing everything right, then it should be okay for the most part.
Yeah.
And then just being in New York, like doing theater and stuff, like we have COVID tests 3 times a week.
Oh, wow.
So it's like we just have to be on our P's and Q's. So
that's how I feel. I'm like, you know what? Don't know what you guys are doing, but I'm going to control me and be safe and be solo because who knows, you know?
Sure, sure. Have you been able to do anything other than virtual tour for this book?
No. Yeah, it's been, I guess, okay, last week, I'm losing all track of time. Last week, I went to Mizzou to do a book event. That was my first in-person thing. But essentially, it was so fun because I was with Wright Thompson and Seth Wickersham, and those are two people I admire. But it was definitely weird. I was like afraid to, you know, interact with humans. I've just been in my apartment for like almost 2 years.
Yeah, it is kind of weird. Like I'm trying to open myself up with going out more, like socially, to try to not just be a psycho that's focused on acting and stand up and just like, oh, I should try to date somebody. I should try to. And so it was kind of like riding on with training wheels a little bit. So,
I still have them. I don't know what's going on. I'm just a hermit over here.
But you're putting out this great work. I want to talk about your book, Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP. But I also want to kind of get under the hood with under your hood a little bit, because you're so great at capturing who these people are in your pieces, like your LaMelo Ball piece, your Monet Davis, the Brandon Ingram piece. What was it like for you? Did you always have aspirations to be a writer?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. I didn't. I wanted to be a basketball player.
Okay.
And I spent my whole, you know, I feel like I always say, like, act one was basketball, act two is sports writing. And it seems natural that the one flowed into the other, but it really wasn't. I, you know, was really having a hard time, you know, stopping playing basketball. I played my first year in college. I wanted to play overseas. And, you know, I think when that dream did not work out, I had to really figure out what I wanted to do. And I've always loved writing. I just never saw it as a career. You know, I've written my whole life, but it was a refuge. It was a hobby. It was a thing that I loved, but I just, you know, who thinks, oh, I could be a writer. So it just happened, you know, kind of organically. I was like, well, if I'm a sports writer, that'll combine my love for basketball and writing, and maybe that can work. So, yeah, definitely was not planned out like this.
How old were you when you realized that? Were you just like 18, 19 when you just like, I'm not going to be a pro baller? Or
I think it was I probably was 20, because it was my sophomore year of college, and I ended up, so I played my first year in college at
Where'd you go to school?
The first year was at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon.
Okay.
And then I transferred to Occidental College back out here. And that's when I stopped playing. So that was 2010. Okay. I was just kind of like, what am I doing? You know, like my whole days used to be filled with just like training all the time, you know? Yeah. And I was like, what do I do with my time? You know? And so, yeah, I guess switching gears just really, I don't know. It saved me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Was there like an internal struggle that you had? Like, were your parents, what did they do? Were they like pushing you towards sports, or did they just support you no matter what?
Definitely supportive no matter what. Architect and teacher, I think I feel lucky. You know, you can't see me right now, but I'm 5 feet tall. And so to have parents that say, like, yeah, we'll support you in your pro basketball dream, or, you know, sports writing, which is like hard on its own. It's almost like becoming, you know, it's any art, any, you know, art field is hard to get into. So luckily I was supported there. But I think, you know, sports writing is something I got into to heal from basketball.
Mm.
But then it turned into something I loved on its own.
Sure.
And that's why I think a lot of my pieces have that human element, because I totally understand what it's like to be an athlete, and I totally have compassion for that. And I guess I'm just more curious about that. You know, I used to be like that girl that carried a basketball everywhere and like could recite random stats about some journeyman from forever.
Wow. Sure,
but now I'm like, you know, I don't really care about the ins and outs of the game. I like the personalities and the people.
A lot of your pieces and a lot of your work, this one, the Giannis piece book itself, just reminds me of those really good Sunday like pieces that come on ESPN, those profiles. Mm-hmm. And I mean this in the best way possible. Like, you're painting pictures, like you paint pictures with your words, because I want to get into it a little later about some of the hardships that you endured making this book, writing this book. But it's just those really, those interesting pieces that make you say, oh, I didn't know that guy went through that. I kind of have more respect for him even more. I'm going to root for this guy now. Like, yeah, it's like it's because with Giannis, I mean, I always felt like I was like, oh, that kid's good at basketball. And he's kind of like this fun loving guy with this Prince Akeem energy with that. That's interesting. So I like this guy. But when I read the book, I was just like, oh, my God, it was great. So I guess where do I want to go from here? When did you really start taking your craft seriously?
Yeah, well, thanks for all your kind words just now. I started taking it seriously, I would say, right after that sophomore year in college. And, you know, I was trying to freelance, and it's hard to break in, right? Because you need experience to break in, but how can you get experience if you don't break it? It's like the chicken or the egg, you know,
right.
Who's going to hire you so you can get experience, but you can't get hired because you don't have experience.
Right.
So it's a lot of, you know, doing stuff for free, but I took it very seriously. You know, I wanted so badly to be great at writing. And I think my first gig at the Orange County Register, so I was there 2013 to 2017, and I was doing work that I guess would be considered, you know, bottom of the totem pole, you know, little league, junior college, high school, you know, it was not the sexy stuff. But I took it so seriously. I mean, I tried to interview everyone related to this person. You know, it's a feature on a 12-year-old that I would interview like 10 people, you know? And so I think at that point I was like, I'm so determined. I want to make it as a features writer, which was not a popular thing, you know? The Sunday takeouts you mentioned, that was already dwindling around that time. So, you know, but I didn't care because I was just like, I want this so badly.
Why is long form writing or feature writing not as popular anymore? Is it like a lost art now, or what is it?
I don't get it, because it's so moving, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and as you mentioned, like it brings you closer to the person that you're watching. I think it's just a lot of people in charge of media companies just decided that it's not worthy, you know, and they say, well, our attention spans. But again, that's, I don't think so. I've seen people binge shows like,
yeah,
like how are you going to, like, if we don't have attention spans, how can you do that? You know? So
right.
I just think it's just a lies that we're telling ourselves, or the people in charge. It's the people in charge. A lot of these companies are not journalists. They're
right.
hedge fund managers. They're media people that are more politicians. There's a lot of dirty money in a lot of these places. And so I think it's just this lie that has consumed media and led to cutbacks and layoffs. But long form is so valuable, even if it's a lost art. It's, you know, I never finish a book or a long form profile on somebody that's done well and think, wow, I just wasted, you know, 25 minutes of my life. I'm like, wow, that was so informative.
Right,
like,
right.
I had no idea that that guy was this. And then you tell your friend, you got to read this thing. Did you know that that person? So I just think, like, we love stories. I don't know why this one form of storytelling is undervalued.
Yeah, because it's fascinating, because it, just to highlight some moments that I really appreciated in the book, the Giannis going after Dunleavy, the first time when we see that, where we see that change, that switch go off. And the facet, I'll say this before we get into that, I'll say I was reading this and it's like, you know what happens, and we can right. talk a little bit about the serendipity of the timing of it all, but I know that he wins the MVP, but I'm reading this last month and I'm in the dressing room at the MVP moment when he's talking, he's accepting the award. I'm welling up. I'm tearing up. I'm just like, and I saw it. I knew what happened.
Right.
And I'm reading this and all these dudes in the back just like talking about whatever they're talking about. I'm just like, oh my God, this is.
That means so much.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it's not that he won the award. It's that you remember his mom working 14 right. hours, sacrificing washing the one pair of socks that he has, or like mm-hmm. the tender detail about like counting his Oreos. Like, you yeah. just understand what a person has gone through to achieve. So it's right. less about the achievement and it's more about the human struggle. And
right.
Wright Thompson said something really cool at that event that I mentioned at Missouri the other day. He was like, I don't know why media tries to find the unicorn, like the, you know, the one-legged gymnast or things like that. What bonds us to stories is the universal.
Right.
And it just really just struck me, right? Because it's like, ostensibly, we should have nothing in common with Giannis, right? Like mm-hmm. we are not 7 feet tall. We don't have his athleticism, but the way that he cares for his brothers, or how hard he works and, you know, falls short. These are all things that relate to us. So I don't know. It means a lot that you related to it, because that's what I hope, you know, that's what I hope to do. That's why I write.
Yeah. Because afterwards, like after I read the book, I then went to YouTube and just went into like, watch some Giannis videos And then seeing those old, the old footage of him being in Greece, like I said, oh, that's what Mirren put in the book. I could, I could already see it in the book, but now like seeing it in on YouTube, I was just, she painted that picture really well. Like, I'm, you know, so like, it was just like, I don't want to get into that part of it yet, but it was just like those, that in particular was great. And even the, so the Dunleavy was great. That's a part of his evolution. And then we get to the Ben Simmons moment, which is kind of like kind of apropos of the times now when he calls him a fucking baby. And it's like, yeah, he is kind of a. But I don't want Kwame Brown coming after me talking bad about
me
talking about a black dude. So, but no, it was just like it was just funny to me because it was just like, oh, that's because, you know, if you're a just a person that's like, Giannis and Ben got into it that night. Okay, wow. And then the context, it was just like, oh, okay, this is a part of his evolution. And I thought, you know, initially when the book first came out, there was the Jason Kidd talk, which I don't think was, I don't know why, I don't know how that got conflated. It was weird because it seemed to me, it was just like, oh, this is really like interesting because Giannis, it made him better. Mm-hmm. And despite the issues that other players had, it seemed like it just kind of fueled Giannis because he's a different dude. What do you think about that? How do you feel about that?
Well, it was unfortunate that, like, that took a life on its own because you would think that the whole book is this salacious, you know, 400 pages of drama. And it was like three paragraphs in there.
Right.
And the book was very balanced. Like you said, like Jason was really good for Giannis in certain ways. And then there were other ways that was not helpful. And, and the manner that he coached was quite toxic, but the book really strived to show the balance and, you know, it was not one or the other. But the internet is going to be the internet. And it was so unfortunate that this book comes out and then that's the storyline, like dominating for like a week. I guess that's what happens. But, you know, that's, you can't control it when you put your art into the world. It's whatever people want to do with it. You know,
it's everybody else's now. It's not even yours anymore.
Right.
And
so it would be a non-issue if he hadn't just been hired. You know, when I wrote the book, he wasn't a head coach. Mm-hmm. So it was not even a thing. I didn't think it was going to be a thing. That's the truth. Like, everyone's a character. The first guy who coached him, the last guy that coached him, the brother, the teammate. So Jason's just one of those people in his life. And you strive to show both sides, but you know, people are going to take what they're going to take.
No, I just appreciated that because I've had people like a Jason Kidd in my life. And I also appreciated there's just those moments where you have to step up in your life. I mean, and I'm using that to just even ask you, like, did you have people like that were somewhat adversarial, but pushed you to be great, like to push you to.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of my basketball coaches were so tough. I think I'm still kind of like unlearning a lot of the perfectionist things that created, you know, when you're 10 years old and this like coach is yelling at you and you're like 10 years old and you don't understand it. And so I think, you know, I've had that my whole life, but I've learned to take in what they say, not how they're saying it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really hard skill. Yeah. Because it hurts when somebody's yelling at you and calling you awful names. But I've totally had people like that. I've had editors like that. It's not my favorite.
Right.
I prefer a good job and here's what we can work on. But
sure. I've had both. Yeah. Like
that. Yeah.
It's interesting because when I was thinking about talking, when we were just doing the research and everything and knowing that I was going to talk to you, it made me think of this story where I think maybe 2007, 2008, I saw Jason Kidd. The first time I had, and the only time I had really good seats
was at a preseason game at MSG, and Jason Kidd, I think he was with the Knicks, but he was towards the end of his career. They were playing against somebody, and it was a preseason game, and just the look in Jason Kidd's eyes that were just so intense that, like, this is preseason, Jason. But I appreciated that from him. But I also appreciate, was Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, one of my other favorite moments in this book was the Giannis having to hit a three-pointer in practice so everybody could go home. Was Jason the coach then?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, yeah. That moment was like where it's kind of like you want to be a leader, but not, and he has to put his lucky like armband on or whatever, and he shoots it and he misses, and he laughs, and it's like, okay, this guy is a leader, this guy works hard, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. It's like that nice balance that I try to go for, where it's like, I take my craft seriously, but I don't want to put that weight on everybody else or just say, I'm working really hard at this. I'm an artist and this is what, you know. So that was one of those moments where, even in the midst of that, under the Jason Kidd regime, where you get to see Giannis kind of, for lack of a better term, take the piss out of that a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's why I think people are so endeared to Giannis, because he's so regular, you know, and he's not afraid to make fun of himself, be humiliated, mess up, airball. And so when Giannis is described as this larger than life figure that has ascended to the, you know, the gods and fairy tale, I'm like, this is like a regular guy, nice guy, hardworking as hell, determined, but just like a regular guy. And I think the ability to laugh at himself in that moment is also what makes teammates see that he's human and he's not a robot, you know? And I think that's why they respond to him, not just because he's the hardest worker on the floor, but he's like a genuine person. But it's complicated because he doesn't let everyone see that side. He's gregarious and guarded. You're very playful, but very serious. Like this is why I think like we need long form and stuff like this, because people have like eight different sides to them. We're 3D, you know, and you want to like show all the sides.
Yeah, it's something interesting. Now that we're talking about this, it's fascinating, because in your great players, it's something that, you know, that was a little off balance for greats like a Tiger Woods and a Kobe,
where a
Jordan in a lot of ways, in which what we saw in The Last Dance, where it's like, this guy's a psycho.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like you want to have that work ethic, but it's just it seemed like Giannis kind of tapped into something that's a little more nuanced, and I'm sure other players have this, but just because we're talking about him now, it's just like, it's an interesting thing that's not really, that we don't really focus on that much in sports.
Well, it's funny because, so when The Last Dance came out, I was reporting the book and I asked people, I was like, I just can't see Giannis like yelling at somebody like that, or just being like such an asshole to the lead. And they were like, look, he has moments where like he's gonna get on you, but you know, like don't get it twisted, like he's going to be intense, but he's not like them. He's just like a different kind of leader. I think that's good. I think, you know, it's almost cliche, right? Mamba mentality, like you know, it's greatness is really hard to pinpoint and to distinguish, and not everybody has that, but Giannis has his own thing.
Yeah.
And it's very intense and it's very hardworking and it's very diligent, but there's also a lightheartedness to him that people want to be around and follow. So I think he has his own style.
Yeah. You know? 'Cause it just seems like when I talk to people like yourself and other artists, it's just like, where is that balance? Because it's almost like being a creative person, almost to be great, it almost takes, like, you have to be monastic about it. You have to be like a Jedi. Yeah. You have to be, I'm going to go off and I'm just going to focus on this thing. And I'm really good at this thing, but I also want to operate in the real world too. So it's just like that balance that I really appreciate it. And I, really appreciate even more now that we're talking about it. I want to talk a little bit about more about the what you went through going through writing this book during the pandemic. Talk a little bit about, I know you're probably tired of talking about it, but I still want to hear it from you. No. I'll put a wrinkle to it. I'll make it a little more fun for you.
Okay.
Talk about, so you initially talked to Giannis's youngest brother, Alex, right?
Yeah.
And you were doing a profile on him for the Bleacher Report. And then it evolved into something more. It essentially evolved into this book.
Yeah.
But what is it about your journalistic instinct, your spidey senses that caused you to think about, oh, there's something more here. What else can I explore in there? There's a book.
Yeah. I mean, I think the moment that like that made me feel how you're talking about, like instinctual, was when I was in their basement and I was talking with Alex and the brother, and he got a call and he's like speaking in Greek. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. And then I asked him like, who is that? And he was like, oh, that's my older brother. And I was like, oh, which one? You know? And he's like, Giannis. And I was like, isn't he like upstairs? Cause Giannis was there that day.
Yeah.
And he was like, Giannis just wanted to make sure that I was okay. You know, it was my first interview. And I just thought that was so adorable, you know? And I just was like, what big brother feels the need to call baby brother downstairs, like just to check on him? So because at the time Giannis hadn't won MVP at all, you know, I think people were just so focused on the athleticism and all you heard was freak, 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 but you didn't hear anything about tenderness or softness. And that phone call just made me, I felt it, you know, I just felt that connection that they had. And I was like, this profile is going to be more about Giannis than Alex. It's going to reveal stuff about both of them. And then I was like, it's that spidey sense. I was like, okay, Giannis's story is a family story. You know, it's bigger than Alex and it's bigger than Giannis. And I just thought like, you know what, I've been trying to write a book. I really want to do one. This is so human. In fact, I'm so much more interested in how Giannis cares for his brothers than I am how he became an amazing basketball player. Of course, the two are related, but you know, that's when I was like, this could be a book.
And what can you talk about? You know, it's the improbable rise of Giannis, but it's almost, you faced some roadblocks writing this book. It was almost improbable for you. Talk a little bit about like, cause you kind of had the organization, the Milwaukee Bucks did not like this idea of you being around, which was weird. Cause this book comes off as a love letter to the organization, Giannis, the community. So can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. So, it's very hard to write a book about a player in real time. Most books are like when the player retires, but I just found this to be such a fascinating, captivating portrait that I wanted to do it in real time. Giannis was, you know, figuring out his Supermax decision. And of course, the Bucks, so paranoid, didn't want anything, you know, like this Supermax is everything to this community, to the city, to this franchise. And I think they just like didn't want anything interfering with this decision. Not that I would interfere or anything. Again, it's like you said, it was so positive. So that sucked. But at the same time, the book is still due. Like with long form, if a story doesn't work out or something, or people aren't willing to help or whatever, there's a million reasons why to kill a story. You can just kill it. But like book deals, you can't kill. The publisher is expecting this. You've been paid to do an assignment. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to have to get Bucks people without them. And like, fortunately, just through my own reporting, I was able to get a lot of Bucks voices from the organization myself. But I think the other struggle was being trapped in my apartment. You know, I was supposed to go to Greece and I had to cancel that trip. And doing everything virtually was hard, especially working in another language. You know, I don't know Greek. I had to work with translators. It was just really hard. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. And also just the difficulty of not really knowing how to do a book. This is my first book. You know, I've been a professional writer for like 7-8 years, but this is a different beast. And so I just think it was so hard. The whole process was just like laced with doubt and fear and uncertainty. So when I see it on the bookshelf, it's still like, oh my God, how did this ever come together? You know?
Yeah, it's I think it's terrific. I mean, not only are you profiling this man, young man, you're painting a landscape around him and the circumstances around which he came from.
Yeah.
And then one of the things that attracted me to this book, you know, I remember being at in Atlantic City doing some gigs at the Borgata or whatever. And I think I saw you. I think it might have been an interview that you did on the Rich Eisen show. But Rich Eisen had a guest host, and she asked you, she said, what's the most interesting thing you found while you were doing the research for this book, putting it together? And you said the racism. And I was like, oh, yeah, now I want it. I want to read this. It's because
like whole, it's like three quarters of the book or
yeah,
maybe a bit much. But yeah, it dominates a lot of the book.
Because like just the little that I knew about him before, super talented dude, Greek. But then you look at him, you're like, your parents are from somewhere else, though.
Right.
And it's like, OK, there's something there. And when you said that, I was like, yeah, I'm getting this. I'm reading this. Talk a little bit about like the racism, the shadow. What was the evil racist?
Golden Dawn.
Golden Dawn. Talk a little bit about the racism and all that stuff. And I'll ask you one more question.
Yeah. Well, I think so with Giannis, like the only version we've heard of this story is this very sanitized story. That's mm-hmm. very fairy tale-y and happy, and race is like never mentioned. And if it is, it's not mentioned in a way that I think is reality. You don't overcome racism. Like it's always there, and it's
yeah.
I just think the framing of his story was just this fairy tale that did a disservice to the actuality. And I think the problem was that nobody really knew what he went through with right. that. And not just back then, but now. I think that was also a surprise to people that he's done so well in his career and yet is still a target of racism in this home country all the time, you know? So to go back to your question, Golden Dawn was this neo-Nazi group that came to rise as Giannis was growing up, and they would patrol majority migrant neighborhoods like Giannis's neighborhood. And they were later to be found a criminal organization. They've literally killed people, beaten people. And it was scary. It's not like Giannis left his house and was like, oh my God, I'm so scared. But there are moments where you see these people and you know you can't be out at night and you know you're a target. And that he definitely experienced that. Mm-hmm. Coupled that with the fact that he was undocumented, even though he was born there, because Greece has a completely different system than us where there's no birthright citizenship. So Giannis grew up with this fear that his parents would get deported. And so I think that the truth is that he was really supported by a lot of well-meaning white Greek people. And there were also so many racist Greek people that shouted insults at him at games too, and did not treat him with integrity. And it even extends to today. So I think it's like, it doesn't satisfy people to learn that, because they think it negates the positives, but you have to hold both in one hand. Mm-hmm. Tons of people did help him. So many people did not. And when you ignore the people that did not, it just paints a rosy narrative that just kind of like wasn't his experience.
Yeah. And it just makes him the rise more improbable, you know?
Well, one thing I want to add, sorry to interrupt you.
Sure,
Can I just add one more thing on this?
Of course.
I think what's so fascinating is the connection or lack of connection with Nigeria that I also wanted to explore.
Sure.
And this idea that like, so he doesn't play for the Nigerian national team, and the basketball game, the USA World game, I guess it's called, I forgot, but he chose to only put the patch of Greece on his jersey instead of mm-hmm. also Nigeria. I think there are these really interesting parts of his story, and people right. like a lot of Nigerian people, you know, journalists that I talk to are just like, we want a deeper connection. It's just not there because he reps right. Greece so hard, you know, the Greek freak. So sure. I think we also have to keep in mind, like, he's 26 years old. Like,
right,
he's still writing his own story. He's still figuring out how all these parts of his identity go together. So I just think it'll be so fascinating whoever writes the next Giannis book about like how his views evolve and does he visit Nigeria more often? Like, I would love to know more about that, you know?
Yeah. Is it in the book where he talks about his son, where you talk about like he's got his, he says, my son's going to live here and
yeah.
I better. Yeah.
In Milwaukee. And so that's fascinating too, mm-hmm. is like, now you're raising a child that's American, mm-hmm. but Greek and Nigerian, you know, you have all these parts to him and you're viewing it through his eyes now. So I just think there's so much more to come yeah. with Giannis' story.
Well, I want to close with this because I know you got to go. And this has been really amazing. I'm really glad that you're able to spend some time with me. You said that this was one of the hardest things you've ever had to do. What did you learn about yourself throughout this process and afterwards? What did you learn?
That's such a good question. Nobody's ever asked me that. I learned that I am a lot tougher than I think I am, and that everything can go wrong and I can still find a way to do it. I think that's so important to know as a journalist, to go through these experiences where like the project seems lost or the project seems impossible or the project is like not working and you could be in a global plague and find a way to get it done, you know? And I think like that did a lot for me as far as like just building, building confidence. And number two, it really put me out of my comfort zone. I am used to not being the story. I don't like attention. Like you'll notice in a lot of my stories, except for the LaMelo ones, I'm not in there. And a lot of profile writing is like, we ate salad together and we are at the thing and we're in the elevator. And I just hate that so much. So
I had blue cheese dressing.
I'm like, I don't care, you know? So I think for me going on this like media tour has been so weird because I'm just so not used to like people asking about me. And it was really scary. And it was really, it was nerve-wracking. It's first time going on TV and putting myself out there. Like there was just a lot of vulnerability moments that happened with this. And I feel like it was just a really good life experience to know like, okay, you can go on TV, you'll survive. You can go on the, you know, sure. media and be okay. And still center your story.
That's great. And now you made me think of another question, but gosh darn it. Well,
ask me one more.
I'll ask you one more. It made me, see, now I kind of lost it.
Oh, no.
Maybe I'll edit this out. What did you learn about yourself? What did you? I know what it was. As a creator at putting this together, there has to be some stuff that you left out. How do you know, even with an editor, how yeah. do you know how to take what to leave in, what to take out?
I mean, that is the hardest part. Mm-hmm. That really, I mean, I rewrote this book like 5 times.
Whoa. Okay. And
there was different versions of it on my computer and some anecdotes were left and then I took them out or my editor took them out. But personally, like, I think I was thinking of every possible way somebody could criticize the book. And I had that in my mind to try to like, figure out, I wanted this book to be like bulletproof. Like there's nothing you could say. Of course, there's going to be criticism no matter what, but that's of course what you think of. And one of the things I was really afraid of was people thinking that it's trauma porn because there's so much hard times. And so I think some of the stuff I took out was like, do we really need another anecdote about going hungry? We get it. There was not food. You know, or like, is this really important? Does this really emphasize something about him? And I think, you know, getting to the heart of it, it's that's why in the book you see a lot, like for every hard moment, there's a light moment. Mm-hmm. He had a really happy childhood. And I think people don't realize that you can be happy and poor. I don't think people like understand that, but it's the truth because that's just your reality. And so I think I took out a lot of trauma and put in a lot of joy.
Okay. Well, Miren, this has been fantastic.
That's so fun.
Thank you so much for doing this. You're going to have to come back.
I will.
Yeah, you have to come back. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And I'll talk to you next time. Take it easy.